On Being is supported in part by Penguin Press, the publishers of Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. Best-selling author Andrew Solomon says of Krista Tippett's new work, "This is a book about kindness and forgiveness and the insight that is contingent on abandoning monolithic paradigms." Available now wherever books are sold.
I'm Krista Tippett, and this is On Being's Unheard Cuts. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Frank Wilczek. Download the MP3 of our produced show with him at onbeing.org. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello, this is Frank.
Dr. Wilczek?
Yes.
Hi.
Frank, hello.
Hi, Frank. And this is that you say your name, Wilczek? Is that?
Yeah, Wilczek is good.
Is it? Where does that name originate? Is it Polish, maybe? Or?
It's Polish. It's an Eastern European name. It means small wolf or wolf cub.
Ah.
It's actually a fairly common name. It's also, it's the name of a royal family in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So there's a Wilczek Palace. There's a Wilczek Land because Count Wilczek bankrolled some expeditions near the North Pole.
Have you been there to the captain?
No. It's way above the Arctic Circle. You can only get there through with icebreakers.
Okay.
It's owned by the Russians.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I'm so happy to have you on the other end of the microphone.
Thank you.
And do you have any...
Yeah, it's good to talk to you. I've heard the show several times, and
great.
I quite enjoy it on Sunday
mornings.
Oh, thank
you. Yeah. Well, thank you. I wondered if you have any questions for me before we start.
Not really. Okay. Well, one thing, I wasn't really quick on the draw enough, but I just wrote a column for the Wall Street Journal that appeared Saturday that I thought might be interesting to discuss. But
what was it about?
It was about an experience I had at the Botanical Garden in Phoenix, the Desert Botanical Garden.
Uh-huh.
There was an art exhibit called Fields of Light by Bruce Munro, which consisted of acres of in the desert on a hillside of lights that slowly pulsated. There was thousands of lights slowly pulsated asynchronously in different colors. And it was dark, you know, it was the nighttime. And it just made me think in a different way about what it might be to wander inside a mind and what thought looks like. Because there were so many. It had a kind of organic feel because of the... The pulsing was roughly in the pace of breathing or heartbeat, and the patterns were always changing. You know, we don't often get to see what scientists call the combinatorial explosion, that there are so many possibilities, so many ways of combining off and on in different colors on that scale. And it was just, to me, it was awesome because it brought together so many analogies and metaphors and ways of thinking about thinking and visualizing it. I suddenly thought that this is what thought really is. I can explain. you can get inside it. Right.
Well, did you? I wonder. Did you always have? I know you grew up. You were your father was an electrical engineer, radio repairman.
Yes.
And it sounds like you had a fascination with how things worked. I mean, there's this story you told somewhere about a coffee percolator that was one of your early memories.
Yes, that's my earliest memory, I'm pretty sure.
Your earliest memory altogether.
Yes. It's pre-verbal. I just remember it in pictures, kind of. But I remember very vividly sitting on my parents' kitchen floor with a tile pattern. And we had a percolator, an old-fashioned coffee percolator, which had seven pieces. And you could take it, and they were big, so it was something I could manipulate even though I was, didn't have fine motor coordination or anything. And I just was taking it apart, putting it back together, seeing that it could actually be done over and over again and that things would fit. And suddenly, somehow it was at that moment that I realized that, that there was a world outside and me inside, and those were different things. And I don't know, it made a big impression on me, and I still remember it very vividly.
Well, you know, it's interesting just the story you just started telling me about. You know, you talk about how you were very drawn to questions of meaning and drawn to philosophy early on, and somehow always making these connections and seeing these echoes and analogies, even in the story you just told about the... Where were you at the botanical...
The Desert Botanical Garden.
Desert Botanical Garden. And so seeing the lights, and but then also thinking about, you know, the external world and the internal world.
Yes.
It seems like you've always made those connections.
Yeah, I guess I have. Something, I'm just obsessed with some things, right? That's definitely one of them. What is the connection between experience, the inner world of consciousness and sensation, and the external world, which kind of impinges on us, whether we like it or not, and has its own structure.
Yeah, you know, I usually begin or very early in my interviews inquire about their religious or spiritual background of someone's childhood. I feel like this discussion we just kind of organically leapt into is kind of an answer to that. It's every bit as relevant an answer as a description of a religious upbringing.
It goes very deep, right? I think touches on some of the same feelings and emotions. But of course, there's more and different in religious, common religious communities and scriptures and belief systems than this kind of universal spirituality.
Yeah,
and I've kind of been through both. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as I've matured, I found the former, the kind of symbolic thinking and trying to understand the inner world and the outer world and their connection, more satisfying and more lasting than the religious traditions, although those are very interesting too, and can it's all interesting.
Yeah.
Everything is interesting,
yeah.
but somehow the for as far as truth value is concerned, I think the truth value of things like science and physics is much more assured than the truth value of scriptures.
And you know, I think we can look at human history and human cultures and see that a lot of beauty, a lot of aesthetic beauty has been brought into the world in religious traditions, music and architecture and calligraphy. But I would say, and I don't want to stretch this too far because you are a scientist and I'm talking to you as a scientist, but there's, you know, I was saying in a sense you take up this question in your most recent book, which was published in 2015, A Beautiful Question, which I would almost say it could almost be a theological question, which you take up as a scientist, you know, and you say this is a long meditation on a single question: does the world embody beautiful ideas?
Yes, and that's what it is.
Yeah, and I want to ask you also, for you, is that question a variation or a corollary or an alternative to the question that is more commonly, that question that's more commonly stated, you know, does the world have meaning? Does it all mean anything?
Well, to me, it's clearly related. It's in the same family. It has some kind of the same feeling about it.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it's much more addressable, and I don't know what it would mean to say what the meaning of the world is.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what an answer could possibly look like. But if we ask this
question, which sort of has the same feeling about it, does the world embody beautiful ideas? I think we can get quite far in finding illuminating answers, and it's a very satisfying discussion because there's a lot of positive evidence. It's not that there's some metaphysical.
No, it's physical evidence. That's right. There's a truth
that rules the world. Yeah. Beauty is a human, to me at least, is a human experience. It's something that has to do with how humans react to the world and perceive the world. But it can also be, and it's notoriously thought to be subjective, but it's not entirely subjective. There's a very rich history of art objects and music and what people have found beautiful,
yeah,
and literature. And we can compare that to what scientists find in their deep investigation of what the world is and see not whether those things coincide. They clearly don't coincide. There are forms of beauty that are not found in science, and there are facts about the world that are not beautiful.
Yeah.
But there's a remarkable intersection, I think, and a remarkable overlap between the concepts of beauty that you find in art and literature and music and things that you find as the deepest themes of our understanding of the physical world.
Well, and, you know, I don't think I've interviewed any, say, group of people across my years of interviewing who use the word beauty more or who have a deeper reverence for beauty than people who work with mathematics.
Yeah, and I'm one.
Yeah.
Several of the most important episodes in my scientific career have been driven not in a vague way, but very concretely by wanting to make things beautiful. I remember almost a magical moment when I was speaking with one of my colleagues after a seminar, trying to figure out what this seminar meant. It was about fractional charge. It was a very difficult seminar to understand. Neither of us really did. But then I tried to write an equation which captured the way it should work, and the equation almost wrote itself. And it was just so pretty that I knew it had to be correct. And that turned out to be the key,
yeah,
to a very important investigation that, you know, it's still ramifying through physics. So that was one experience. Another experience was with the origin of our theory of the strong interaction. We went through all kinds of difficulties in relating the equations that we thought might describe the strong interaction to basic facts about the world. There are many paradoxes, contradictions almost, that seemed to be a barrier to these equations being correct. But the equations were so beautiful and some of their consequences were so compelling that we didn't want to give up on them. Mm-hmm. And so we insisted on that. And you stick to this theory. You have to. It's, if you don't understand it, it's your problem. and that turned out to be the right thing to do. All the difficulties proved to be superficial, and eventually we overcame them. But if we didn't have faith in the beauty of the physical world, that the explanation would ultimately be compelling and beautiful, it would have been very easy to give up. It would have been very sensible to give up, actually.
That your work on the strong interaction was what won you the Nobel Prize, is that correct, in 2004?
Yes.
That's the work. I want to just mention a few things before we keep going. That, you know, one of the things you do is you propose different language for some of the language that gets that is more standard, like the standard model of physics. And
yes.
I think you always, and I want to say this, I think, you know, you, instead of standard model, you propose working with the language of core theory, which I think in every case where you rename things, it's also more elegant. and
thank you.
And poetic and and also more precise at the same time language.
Well, I think naming things is extremely important.
Yes.
And not only me, some of my great heroes in physics, and for that matter also in philosophy, thought very, very hard and took it very, very seriously naming things. A lot of letters, correspondence of Faraday is concerned with what names he should give to the things he was discovering. And a lot of our terminology that we still use comes out of that. And whereas some modern terminology like top quark and bottom quark, and you know, that's not so good. Well, even quark. Not so good.
Although quark came from James Joyce. Wasn't that a literary allusion?
Yeah, quark is from Finnegan's Wake, yeah. I think. Yeah, three quarks.
What is it you call gravity? Instead of gravity, you speak of geometry encoding fluids. Is that right?
Well, instead of fields, there's
fields
a...
Fields of gravity,
Instead of fields, I talk about fluids.
Yes.
Well, this gets a little technical, but fields is used for two different things in physics, which is really unsatisfactory. It's used for the entities that fill space and do things, and it's also used for the values that those entities take. And that's a subtle distinction, but very important. And if you use the same word for those two different things, it causes no end of confusion. Most physicists don't seem to be bothered by it because we're familiar with it. But when you try to explain things to other people, I've seen it be very confusing. So at the risk of being pedantic, I introduced a new word for one of the uses, which goes back to the original use that original terminology that people like Faraday and Maxwell, who invented these things, used, and called the substance itself a fluid, like the electromagnetic fluid, whereas its values are things like electric fields and magnetic fields.
Let's see.
So in outer space, for instance, where the value of the magnetic field is zero, the magnetic fluid is still there, and it's ready to be excited and move around if stimulated. So those are two very different concepts, and not keeping them separate is really confusing.
Mm. Thank you. Thank you for that explanation. You know, I think when one talks about mathematical beauty or beauty as revealed through mathematics and physics, that can sound lofty and abstract to many people.
Yes.
You make a wonderful observation that I think is just so useful in terms of letting people in, which is that our brains are attuned to the deep structure of the physical world in ways that we can't even begin to grasp, but that so that, for example, you say each of us, and when it comes to beauty and our perception of beauty, or our perception of reality, in fact, our perception of the physical world, you say each of us is born to become an accomplished, if unconscious, practitioner of projective geometry. So explain
that's
what
right.
you're
that's
describing.
That's one of our most impressive abilities.
Yeah.
That humans, children, do routinely without thinking about it, although they have to learn it, parts of it. And yet we have not been able to teach sophisticated computers to do it. That is, humans do an astonishing feat routinely and very quickly. That is, they interpret the messages coming through little openings in their eyes and projected on a two-dimensional screen, the retina at the back, which then get turned, the light gets turned into electrical signals. And from that crazy scrambled encoding, we reconstruct an external world of three-dimensional objects in space. We recognize that if we move our head, they're still the same objects, and we determine these effortlessly. We do a job which is, well, it literally is impossible. We use all kinds of tricks and rules of thumb to guess what the external world is, and sometimes it's wrong with optical illusions. But basically, In most circumstances, we do this remarkable feat of reconstructing a three-dimensional world from two-dimensional information that's all scrambled up with things on top of each other.
Yeah. Through these eyes that we just take for granted, completely and utterly
take
for
granted.
Granted.
But nature has equipped us with extraordinary abilities in geometry. I knew this abstractly, but in preparing the book, I decided I should actually learn something about perspective and projective geometry, and it was a real revelation. I'm terrible at drawing, just terrible, the worst person I've ever met. But I learned some of the rules of perspective that artists use, and they are just so beautiful. They're so elegant, and using them, I was empowered to create accurate kind of buildings and town squares and so forth. I just astonished myself with things that, of course, I could do passively. I could certainly recognize scenes and so forth, but I didn't know how I did it. And I wasn't able to reproduce it sort of consciously. But now with knowledge, I was able to do it, and it was just magic to suddenly see these things emerging from geometric constructions, and it looks like the external world. It had a tremendous effect historically and psychologically when these rules were discovered in the Italian Renaissance. It's one of the things that really powered the Renaissance. The artists took enormous joy in their sudden ability to render the world the way it actually looked.
But that is so interesting, again, to make that, to point that out, that what we, I mean, most of us would be impossible to think about creating perspective, which is essentially creating three-dimensional image on two-dimensional space. But we don't realize that we do that in when we open our eyes constantly without being aware of it, and how complex and amazing that
is.
Yes.
But and people who started to work on artificial intelligence thought at the beginning that would all be trivial because it's so easy. we don't have to work very hard.
Right.
They thought that would be very easy, whereas, say, teaching a computer to play chess would be very difficult. But it's turned out to be just the opposite.
Right.
The things that we do unconsciously and are part of our daily lives and are important for survival are things we're really, really good at. Mm. And it should have been obvious, really, in retrospect, because so much of our brain is devoted to visual processing. There has to be something going on there.
So symmetry is an important notion in the perception of beauty and for the human brain. And I want to tease out, I believe, and I want to make sure I get this right, you're saying that Einstein's kind of what you say call his new style in physics helped bring symmetry home, in a sense, or underscored, helped us understand the importance of symmetry or symmetry as an aspect of reality. How would you say that?
Can you hear me?
Oh.
Something's gone.
Hello?
Oh. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought he stopped abruptly, but I didn't know he's gone.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, yes, I can.
Yeah, okay. So something happened there.
Well, I kind of thought you ended your sentence quite abruptly, but I didn't know you were gone.
So I'm sorry, but so do you want to repeat the question?
I think that was fine. So did you hear my question about symmetry?
Yes, the question
Einstein?
Was about symmetry
yes.
and Einstein.
Yes. So what was it that Einstein brought that helped illuminate this more completely for us?
Well, symmetry, as used in common language, is kind of a vague word. It means balance, harmony.
Yeah.
Goodness. Somehow it has nice connotations.
Yeah, I like the way you said it's also
it's
fairness. Symmetry, ethical
yes.
symmetry we look for. Yeah.
Yes. Proportion. But in science, we need to have a more precise concept. And the concept that we use that's more precise, that has something in common with the common usage but is
a special case of it and gets amplified in different directions, is that symmetry in physics and mathematics means change without change. Now, that seems kind of mysterious and mystical, but it means something very concrete. Let's talk about it in a couple of cases. Mm-hmm. So one case is an important fact about the physical laws that we know, then everything in physics and science depends on it in some way, is that they don't change with time. In the fundamental equations, that's formulated as a symmetry that says that if you change the equations by advancing time, the laws don't change.
Right.
They might have changed, but in fact they don't change. Einstein's theory of relativity is a very much deeper or at least less obvious application of that kind of idea of change without change. It says that if you ride by the world at a constant velocity, any constant velocity, although things will look different, so some things will be coming at you, other things will be moving away faster, and the same physical laws will apply to this new configuration of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So you can make a change in the way everything looks, but you don't change the laws. A simpler example might be helpful here. We're used to the idea that a circle is a very symmetrical object. What does that have to do with change without change? Well, a circle is an object that you can rotate around its center by any angle. And although it might have changed, and every point, in fact, moves, the circle as a whole does not move. And that's what makes it symmetric. If you take a more lopsided shape and you rotate it, there's no way it won't come back to itself until you go all the way around. So if you take an equilateral triangle, it'll come around after you turn it one-third of the way. So it has some symmetry, but much less than a circle. So that's a concept, change without change, things that might have changed but don't, that picks out special kinds of objects like circles. It also picks out special kinds of theories like special relativity and special kinds of equations that you can manipulate and make changes on without changing their consequences. It turns out that very symmetric laws are laws that seem to be the laws that nature likes.
Mm.
Nature likes laws and likes equations that support enormous possibilities for transformation where things look different, get different names, and different situations are described, but the same equations apply. In fact,
yes.
In recent physics, that's how we've guessed the equations. We guess equations that have enormous amounts of symmetry, work out their consequences, and see if they describe the world. That kind of guesswork is how we got the theory of the strong interactions. And previously I mentioned that we had faith in them despite difficulties because they were so beautiful and compelling. And an important part of their beauty was their symmetry.
So right.
That's the way it works.
Frank, there's something. My engineer is saying we need to check something on your end, technical.
Okay.
They're gonna come in.
Sure.
Sorry.
This is so, fully seated.
Yeah. Okay.
And this is seated correctly, but yes, they are. Okay, we'll keep our ears out for it.
Okay, he didn't find any difficulty.
Okay.
Everything seems to be seated pretty well, so we'll just proceed and keep our ears open for this.
Okay, can we go again? All right.
I'm fine. Yeah.
Is it right? Did I read that you owned and lived in the house Einstein lived in Princeton?
Yes, yes. Throughout the 1990s, we did.
So that would have been the house where he invited Marian Anderson to come stay when she came to sing in Princeton, and it was a segregated city, and she couldn't stay in any of the nice hotels.
Yes, that was the house, all right.
Yeah. Amazing.
It's a nice house.
Good. I'm glad she had a nice place to stay, and so did you.
It doesn't look large from the street, but it's very, very long. It's a big house and has a beautiful yard. Yeah, I liked it very much.
I want to actually point out that there was a piece on December 31st in the Wall Street Journal where they asked a number of thinkers what to expect in 2016, and that you predicted that we would soon detect gravitational waves, which, again, you, yes, I feel, more poetically called tremors in space-time. And in fact, you were proven correct very soon.
Yes. Yeah. And I didn't have any inside information, but I did know what was publicly available, that this instrument was going to acquire enough sensitivity to plausibly detect sources that were very likely to be out there in the universe. And so I wasn't completely confident that it would be found in a year. I was very confident it would be found in a few years.
Yeah.
But as it happened, it was a matter of months after I made the prediction. It's a great event for physics. And
Was that an exciting day for you? What was that like?
Yeah, definitely. Uh-huh. It was a beautiful, a poetic day because many narratives come together. It was 100 years ago that Einstein, from very kind of abstract intuitions of beauty and coherence, wrote down the modern equations for gravity, his general relativity theory, which has has been the pattern for many of our successful theories later, including our theory of the strong interaction. But the effects that and this gave a new picture of what gravity is due to, and it's due to warpings in space and time, an extraordinary concept that space and time themselves can be bent. And then as part of it, the kind of excitations in space and time can take on a life of their own. Those are gravitational waves that move out, spread like ripples on a pond to far away. And you could, in principle, things that happen way over there can transmit through these waves information very far away, like light waves, but it's a different kind of thing you're sensitive to. But the effects were predicted to be so small that Einstein himself had no hope that they would ever be detected. It's another part of the extraordinary progress in physics that we've learned. The technology has advanced so that we can detect extraordinarily small, subtle effects. The effect that's measured in these gravitational waves is a change in the length between two mirrors. Well, actually, several mirrors. You have to have several so that you can do various checks. But a change in the relative distance between these two mirrors, which are pairs of mirrors that are 4 kilometers apart, and the amount of the change in their distance is about 1/1,000th of the diameter of a proton. Unbelievably small displacements. Of course, you don't measure one proton. You measure many, many protons and take an average, so it makes sense. But the fact that physics has advanced to the point where you can master nature so well as to detect such tiny effects reliably is just an extraordinary tribute to how well we've come to understand
kind of
many
in your
things
lifetime,
about the world.
That advance and that change.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's actually scary. I mean, you know, it's 100 years to 100 years back to the origin of the prediction of gravitational waves, and I've lived more than half of that.
Somewhere you describe...
I still think of myself as a kid, but
well,
it adds up, you know?
Well, aging has changed in that 100 years, too, so you're much younger than you would have been if you were living in Einstein's age. So somewhere you say, this is again such helpful imagery, you know, you say Einstein describes space-time as elastic and not rigid, and then you describe it as a ubiquitous cosmic jello. I think those are your words rather than his.
Yes.
But
yes.
it's an image that's helpful.
Yeah, I think so. I'd like to try to think very concretely, although, mm-hmm. you know, to really be accurate in modern physics, we deal with very abstract concepts that are far removed from daily life. But I always try to visualize it in many different ways, including things that are very lowbrow.
Yeah, right. Like jello. Okay, so
yes.
So let's go deep and profound again. You talk about Niels Bohr's notion of complementarity
yes.
as something you've come to treasure, and he was, of course, a Danish physicist and philosopher and an interlocutor of Einstein.
Yes.
You could say.
He's one of the great pioneers of quantum mechanics.
Yeah, and quantum mechanics
right.
and.
He's one of the few people you could think of as Einstein's peer.
Right. And they had a complex relationship in terms of, it seems, huge reverence for each other, but also often disagreeing kind of profoundly.
Yes, they both had deep intuitions about how the world should work. And they weren't the same intuitions.
Yeah, right.
To oversimplify quite a bit, I would say Niels Bohr had a very humanistic interpretation. He thought that physics was about describing human knowledge of the world,
mm-hmm.
whereas Einstein thought more at the level of God's knowledge. He often talked that way.
It's very majestic.
Very majestic and kind of humans are just observers of this pre-existing harmony, and they should be awestruck and humble, but not. Their role was passive, not mm-hmm.
But almost, to that give and take, that seeming conflict, which in fact was as much collegial as it was conflicted.
Yes.
You know, you have such an interesting way of talking about complementarity that I feel is evocative in human terms as well as scientific terms. And I just like to. So one of the things you say is that in ordinary reality, in ordinary time and space, the opposite of a truth is a falsehood. But you say, deep propositions have a meaning that goes beyond their surface. This is so interesting. You can recognize a deep truth by the feature that its opposite is also a deep truth.
Yes.
So one of the conflicts is light a particle or a wave, and in fact, it is both.
It's both. And
it's both,
sometimes
right.
it's useful to think of it one way. Sometimes it's useful to think of it another way.
Uh-huh.
And both ways of thinking are valid in their own terms. Both can be informative in different circumstances. But it's very difficult, in fact, impossible to apply them both at once.
To apply them both at the same time.
And I think that's the essence of complementarity.
Uh-huh.
You have to view the world in different ways to do it justice. And the different ways can each be very rich, can each be internally consistent, can each have its own language and rules, but they may be mutually incompatible. And to do full justice to reality, you have to take both of them into account.
Somewhere you say, complementarity is both a feature of physical reality and a lesson in wisdom. And I think just what you just said about reality is equally true of, and I know you have to be careful to do too much of this, stretching these things, but it's equally true of the human condition.
Oh, very much so. Oh, I think so. When people ask me what my religion is, I say I'm a complementarian.
That's right.
I believe that it's really interesting and really fun and really informative and the right thing to do to be able to look at things in different ways mm-hmm. and appreciate there are different ways of looking at things that each have their own validity. And they may conflict if you try to apply them both at once. But, okay, that's fine. You apply one at a time and try to appreciate both.
And in terms of this, you know, I have spoken with physicists who will say, you know, of course they take their daily perceptions seriously on some level. They understand that essentially what we perceive to be a reality is full of illusion, and including the perception that we have freedom and choice. But, you know, you also present this as another piece of complementarity, two things that in fact are true, each at the same time, or each true, but perhaps that hard to speak about in the same moment. You know, that
yes,
you as a human being are nothing but a collection of particles and light, and you are a thinking, feeling human being.
Yes, I think those are both true. Mm-hmm. And they are different ways of organizing our experience of the world. And each one tells us important things. Each one can be very useful in certain applications. But they're very difficult to apply simultaneously because they're just from different worlds. It's like things I can definitely point to in physics and mathematics where this is not just a vague idea but a theorem. You know, you can think of something as a particle or you can think of it as a wave, and either description can be very rich and full, but you can't do it both at the same time. They're inconsistent.
And so you just have to live that. Then there's some virtue, some intelligence in living with that.
Yes.
That seeming impossibility or contradiction, which I guess human beings don't like, right? We don't like that kind of uncertainty.
I like it.
Yeah.
You can come to like it.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's, as I said, I think that's a bit of wisdom, an important part of wisdom is to...
There's
one aspect of it is just to be able to put yourself in the other fellow's shoes.
Yes.
Right? Think of it.
Right.
But it applies it much more broadly.
Yeah. You have another notion, and I may be stretching to bring it in this context, of entangled histories, which is very evocative.
Yes.
You know, somewhere you said, choose your own adventure books are fun, but they have nothing on quantum mechanics.
Yeah, well, this is something that I've been working on very recently and continue to work on. Well, it gets a little bit technical, but basically in the way people have dealt with quantum mechanics, they've emphasized the notion of a state and an observation on a state, which is telling you how something is at a given time. So it's in a given state at a given time. You measure its properties in that state. And if you want to do a measurement later, you can have a state and you can have a measurement.
So you're looking at a photon, for example.
Okay. In constructing a complete description of the world, and there are other things that don't fit very naturally into that kind of framework. There may be situations in which you don't know the state of a particle at one time or its state at another time, but you know something about the relationship between those states. And so in that context, it's more natural to talk about histories and instead of classifying how a system is in terms of states, to describe it in terms of histories. And the histories can have properties that are very difficult to describe in terms of would be very awkward to describe in terms of the proper if you slice it up and divide it into states as a function of time. And one of those is this notion of entangled histories. And basically what it is a mathematically – I've come to realize. I didn't realize this at first. But what it is I think a mathematically precise version of the intuition that many physicists have had called the many-worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
That the formalism of quantum mechanics, its wave functions, contain a much richer universe than the universe that any person observes. The notion of entangled histories is that it captures that by saying there are many different possibilities for how a system could have evolved that are mutually incompatible, but yet have the same beginning state and the same end state, and you can mathematically prove that the only way to get from that beginning to that end is by the world diverging in different paths,
so,
and then later
coming
together.
So rather than this idea we would have that some other history or chronology would break off and be someplace else over there, this idea is that there are maybe multiple chronologies that actually interact.
Yeah, they can be brought back together.
Right.
For small systems. For big systems, they rapidly get so different that they can't meaningfully be brought back together again. But in small systems, you can observe that you get contributions from these incompatible histories.
And that, again, is just so evocative. That you can't actually make sense of the past or of the state that you're trying to describe without factoring in different realities.
That the quantum mechanical notion of history, just like the quantum mechanical notion of state, is different from the classical notion and richer. And just as we've had to wrestle with the notion of what quantum mechanical reality is at the level of states, I think we also get to wrestle with it again and learn new, fascinating aspects of reality that philosophers never dreamed of. By examining how quantum mechanics works at the level of history.
You know, you use words a lot like paradoxical, crazy, strange to describe reality and what you study. And it seems to me that those words also go together with beauty, right? That the richness of it is also in notions like that.
Yes. Well, one of my notions about the human concept of beauty is that beautiful things are something are things that evolution has primed us to enjoy and want to come back to and feel pleasure in experiencing. One thing that has that nature is learning things that are useful in getting around in the world. So things we can learn from, new experiences that can help us in other endeavors, give us pleasure. And learning about the world and learning about how strange it is
and being taken by surprise in ways that we couldn't have imagined before.
Learning things is expanding your concepts, your power, your appreciation of the world. So I think that is beautiful. It's intrinsically beautiful to learn things.
It's pleasurable, yeah.
Especially if they're surprising, because then you get to expand your mind.
You know, one of my favorite stories about Einstein and Bohr is that, of course, there was that phrase of Einstein, which people sometimes quote as though he's talking about God, but he was actually talking about quantum physics, right? And where he said God, where he says God does not play dice with the universe, and that Bohr came back and said, "Who is Einstein to tell God what to do?"
Yes. Well, Einstein, on many occasions, turned out to be a pretty reliable messenger of what God was attending to. But I think in that case, he was way off base, actually.
Yeah.
If you think, I mean, this is often presented as a kind of very obscure debate and so, but actually, if you think about what happens at a modern particle physics accelerator like the LHC, or even better, its predecessor, the LEP, the electron-positron collider, what happens at an accelerator like that is that people do the same thing over and over again. They collide electrons and positrons with exactly the same properties, exactly the same energy, many, many times. And you get different results each time. You get different kinds of things come out of the reactions. So, you know, Einstein said, or was reputed to say, it's, I guess it's disputed whether he actually said it.
He's, yeah.
But he's famous for having said.
Something like
it. Say it. He's famous for having said, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different answer.
It's so good.
But that's exactly what happens.
Yes.
That's exactly what happens.
Even with this, with him.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
You say in your book, A Beautiful Question, that and that if there is a creator, if you were to ponder it in that way, that creator is an artist above all.
Yes, that's what I think maybe the most poetic way of stating this conclusion, that the world in large part does embody beautiful ideas,
mm-hmm.
that if you regard the world as a work of art, first of all, it helps you understand things, and secondly, it's a pretty good work of art. It's a very rich work of art. You can find it's very surprising. It has tremendous beauty. It has tremendous creative power in using a few principles to make elaborate structures. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing.
I was thinking as I was preparing to speak with you that. I had an interview years ago. It was really in the early post 9/11 years with a Muslim scholar, a great Muslim legal scholar, and kind of jurisprudence in Islam is what theology is in Judaism and mm-hmm. Christianity. And he was a legal scholar, and then a rabbi. And there is a notion in Islam that beauty is a core moral value. Are you familiar with that? And that
I'm not, but what I am familiar with uh-huh. is that mosque interiors are among the most exuberant expressions of symmetry.
Yes.
And celebrations of concepts that turn out to be central to the deep description of the world. It's very impressive.
Yeah,
and of course they're just beautiful to look at.
Right, yeah. But I think it's a reflection of a deep piece of theology and. You know, the rabbi came back with this notion that's in the Hebrew Bible about the beauty of holiness. We had this amazing discussion that night about, taking on the very serious and heavy conflicts in which religion is not just involved but implicated.
Yes.
But imagining beauty as a litmus test of whether something is of God. And then, you know, they had a very complex, actually, understanding of beauty, that it's creative and not destructive, that it's a beauty of wholeness, not fractionalizing.
Mm. Well, I think it would be a very healthy thing as well as a very rewarding thing
yeah.
for religious traditions to focus on, where they'd find a lot of common ground and also rich
yeah.
possibilities. In exploring the concept of beauty. And I think it would also be very helpful and very healthy and very stimulating to bring in science there, because science, has, especially modern physics, has taught us some really, really surprising and wonderfully imaginative and beautiful and fantastic things that are aspects of the actual physical world that are, mm-hmm. and presumably in a religious interpretation are aspects of God's work that are by no means obvious, and you really have to expand your mind to appreciate them.
Yeah.
And to me, at least, it gives a real feeling of spiritual growth and depth when I deal with these concepts.
There's a passage in A Beautiful Question. I just want to read it. It's a beautiful passage, and it kind of gets at this. You know, it's a scientific corollary to that idea of beauty as a litmus test, as a guide. For you, in terms of what science's limits and imperfections, like you say, despite its overwhelming virtues, the core theory is imperfect. Indeed, precisely because it is such a faithful description of reality, we must, in pursuit of our question, hold it to the highest aesthetic standards. So scrutinized, the core theory reveals flaws. Its equations are lopsided, and they contain several loosely connected pieces. Furthermore, the core theory does not account for so-called dark matter and dark energy. Although those tenuous forms of matter are negligible in our immediate neighborhood, they persist in the interstellar and intergalactic voids and thereby come to dominate the overall mass of the universe. For these and other reasons, we cannot remain satisfied. And then you say, having tasted beauty at the heart of the world, we hunger for more. In this quest, there is, I think, no more promising guide than beauty itself.
Yes. Well, I mean, I put my money where my mouth is. Yes. I have theories for what the dark matter is that I think are certainly driven by beauty. Mm. And well, we'll see if they're true. But in recent experience, and I have theories about states of matter that I'm very confident are correct, that they're driven by beauty but haven't yet been verified experimentally. It's what drives a lot of my work in physics is trying to get more beautiful equations and a more coherent description of how things work. So that's how I work. And it's been successful in the past quite a bit, and so it has a good record, not only in my work but in the work of my community and colleagues. So, I think we're on a roll, and let's hope it keeps going.
Yeah. You, George Dyson said something when he was looking at your book that you're kind of in the lineage of natural philosophy that existed before what we now just call science. And I think you...
Yes, I feel that way.
Do you? Yeah, and I really hear that.
I'm a throwback.
And, yes, yes. And that, in fact, I mean, that gets a bit at what we spoke about in the very beginning, you know, this quest for meaning or these questions of meaning that help draw you into science. And then, in fact, that is there on scientific frontiers, and it's where it's often not acknowledged or analyzed.
Yeah, well, I think it's... It has dangers. I mean, it has dangers of woolly thinking and wishful thinking and denial of facts that you don't like. But I think it's throwing out the baby with the bathwater not to realize that that's really a central element of human life and should be a central element of the scientific and worldview to try to understand things whole and bring everything together and use what you learn about the physical world to inform your view of the world as a whole. You have to use it perhaps in the spirit of complementarity, not try to...
tie it up neatly.
Not try to use it to deny other ways of looking at things, but to appreciate them all in different aspects and enrich your concept of what reality is.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's woolly if you are working with a simplistic form or definition of what the search for meaning. Just like beauty can be a woolly concept if you're using it simplistically and superficially.
Exactly. So the challenge is to use them creatively and precisely and to stretch them and test them and push them as hard as they can and see as you can and see if they keep holding up and keep working and keep being creative and fruitful.
And so for just our last few minutes here, I want to I pulled out some observations you make, some insights you have about this way that you see the world, you see reality and truth, and also are always, I think, in some way bringing together these profound human quests for both understanding reality and having a sense of meaning. And one of them, and I just wonder if you'd just kind of bring us in a little bit to this way of seeing. So for example, you talk about how Newton had described each spectral color as distinct.
Yes.
But in the next chapter of physics, there was this discovery of a deep unity beneath and supporting the diversity of appearance. And you said, all colors are one thing. This is what we learned. All colors are one thing seen in different states of motion. And that is science's brilliantly poetic answer to Keats' complaint that science unweaves a rainbow. So explain what that means, that all colors are one thing seen in different states of motion.
Yes. Well, this comes back to the theory of relativity. According to the theory of relativity, if you move past the world at a constant velocity, things look different, but the same laws apply. And that means that if you see one thing when you're at rest and another thing when you're moving, those two things are really the same thing because they obey the related laws. And in the theory of relativity, when you apply it to light, we have a very well-developed theory of what light is based on electromagnetism, and that's part of what drove the theory of relativity in the first place. There are many tests and so forth. So what you learn in the theory of relativity is that when you look at light, a light beam of a different color, and you're moving towards it, it gets shifted towards the blue end of the rainbow. So, mm-hmm. So if it was red, it might become yellow or green or blue or ultraviolet if you're moving fast enough. And if you're moving away, there's what's called the redshift. Things move towards the opposite end of the rainbow. All these colors are real, can be derived from one of them by moving at an appropriate velocity. So really, the existence of one implies the existence of all the others,
right.
And the properties of one imply the properties of all the others. So in a really deep sense, they are the same thing. Mm. But in a complementary sense, if you don't move, they're all different.
So. Is it right that the redshift, that this perception was part of what helped us understand that the universe is expanding?
It's expanding. Oh, yeah, absolutely. It is the central observation that led to the picture of an expanding universe. And that is, you find that, we should backtrack one step. Atoms typically emit light of characteristic wavelength. So neon signs, for instance, like to emit red, famous neon gas, when it's heated, likes to emit red. What was discovered is that the characteristic wavelengths of things seen in distant galaxies was systematically shifted towards the red end of the spectrum. Mm. And that can be interpreted as the fact that we're moving away from them or they're moving away from us. But in any case, the further they go, the further away you look, the faster they're moving. So this was discovered in kind of primitive form in the 20s, and since then it's become very, very well established and now is a rich technique for inferring the size and shape of the universe and where things are in them.
Hmm. I said to you earlier on that your question, does the world embody beautiful ideas, you know, almost could sound like a theological question, and you've an observation that reminds me of, you know, for example, the theological observation of like a Reinhold Niebuhr, you know, one of the great public theologians of the 20th century, talking about how the great struggle of human life and is this anxiety that we feel because we're torn between our experience of mortality and our perception of eternity. And, you know, you said we humans are poised between microcosm and macrocosm, containing one, sensing the other, comprehending both.
Yes.
What are you saying there?
Well, I'm saying that I guess that by understanding the world better, and that you gain a new perspective on what you are, and a different feeling about your place in reality, and that's more realistic, also richer, and has a, there's good news and there's bad news.
Right. I mean, it's challenging, right? It's confusing.
It's something you can, by understanding it deeply, you can certainly enrich your experience of the life you're given.
Yeah. You also cite somewhere what you say is for you one of the most beautiful passages in literature from the 20th century physicist Hermann
Weyl, yes.
On space-time. Like he's talking about space-time from a God's eye view. The objective world simply is. It does not happen. Only to the gaze of my consciousness crawling along the lifeline of my body does a section of this world come to life as a fleeting image in space which continually changes in time. That's a very, it's almost a mystical image. That the world is, it does not happen is quite a remarkable thing to try to take in.
Yes, but it's really, I think, very much what the theory of relativity suggests. In the theory of relativity, it's really basic to think of space-time as a whole. Because there are relationships between things that happen in different parts of space and at different times that would be very, very – that are significant in forming the laws and the regularities of the world that would be – that are very, very difficult and awkward to express if you carve the world into time slices as
right,
we experience
past, present, future.
And regard them as separate and unrelated or – you know, as kind of snapshots, each a thing in itself. Relativity teaches us to think of space-time as a whole and that it's very unnatural to divide them. So it leads, I think, very much to the worldview that Hermann Weyl was alluding to there, that the world, that is space-time, it simply is. It does not happen. It's already encompasses all times.
But so this idea that is in, you know, is in our spiritual traditions, but not that we don't feel in our bodies.
Yes.
Right? That we somehow need to separate to see the past and the future and the present as, although we actually know, we're learning on all kinds of different levels, scientific and otherwise, in the 21st century to try to step beyond just that sensory, instinctive.
We humans have the fate, which is a gift, that we can get beyond the limitations that nature kind of imposed, mm-hmm. that evolution imposed on us. We really can get beyond that by thought. We have the gift of being able to understand things and go deeper and get beyond common perceptions. We can use instruments. We can use logic. We can learn from each other and traditions. And there are many surprises that get revealed.
Yeah.
And it just enormously deepens life to participate in that.
I listened to an interview you gave on the BBC. It was actually a music program. Do you remember this?
Oh, yes.
Was it lovely?
Well, I think so.
Yeah. Well, don't worry. I'm not going to ask you to quote back.
Oh, I know. Yes. I know what you mean. Yes. Where we went through different favorite pieces
Favorite pieces of music. And at one point you said, you quoted Newton. I think you were quoting Newton, that how he said he felt kind of at some point in his life is how you feel. It was like an analogy of feeling like a boy on a beach. Do you remember that?
Yes. Yeah, well, it's a very striking quotation of Newton, and I think very sincere on his part.
Mm-hmm.
He made extraordinary discoveries in foundations of the physics of his time. But he also had many investigations in theology, in what we now call chemistry, but really was more like alchemy at that time, that he fully realized did not get to the bottom of things, that they were loose ends and things that didn't work, especially in the chemistry. So he said that, I think I can quote it close to literally. He said, "I know not how I appear to the world, but to myself I appear like a boy on a beach who came upon some particularly beautiful pebbles while the great ocean of the unknown lay before me." So he realized that he understood some things very well, and he understood what it meant to really understand something. But at the part of that is realizing that you don't understand a lot of things. There's a profound humility that comes from really understanding something, because then you understand what it means to really understand something. Mm. And the kind of woolly, less satisfactory, less full understanding that we have to settle for in many domains, you realize how much is missing, that it's different. Another quotation that's related to that that I really love is from Olaf Stapleton, the great science fiction writer. He put this in the mouth of Odd John, which is his Superman character, who's talking to his human friend. And Odd John says, "You are the Archaeopteryx of the spirit." And I think that's true. We humans we're good enough. We can do a few things. We can understand what it might mean to fly, but we don't actually fly very well.
And you feel that way as a physicist at this juncture in physics, which is so far from what Newton could have imagined also.
Yes. We've done very, very well. No, physics is pretty good. Physics, we've attained a high level, although there are certainly big holes in our understanding.
Yeah.
Most of the mass of the universe we haven't really identified. But we've obviously made enormous strides in understanding the world, and we can support very elaborate technologies. We can make iPhones. We can detect gravitational waves and so forth and so on. When it comes to the mind, when it comes to understanding society, our understanding is much, much less satisfactory. And I'm fully aware of that.
There's the very end of A Beautiful Question. This is another piece of complementarity that you end with, and it's the ultimate one of the big quandaries, puzzles of human life. You say the physical world embodies beauty. The physical world is home to squalor, suffering, and strife. In neither aspect should we forget the other. It's not a haiku, but it's a very condensed way of describing what you just said about what we're capable of and the complexity of that.
So, right. So we human beings have done many wonderful things, but they've also done many awful things. and all we can do is try to expand on the former and minimize the latter. Mm-hmm. And but thinking about science and what we've achieved in science and art and how it fulfills the strivings of the past and how it's brought us so many surprises and so much power, I think is definitely one of the positive aspects of human experience. Mm-hmm.
So just in closing, I wonder if you could just start to talk about how would you begin to reflect on, through the science you've done, and especially I think this focus on your sense of beauty and beauty as a guide, as a litmus test, how do you think you move through life differently? Ordinary space and time, the flawed way we perceive it. How does this change you, affect you in ways that you can... See,
well, I think it's made me much more tolerant.
Yeah.
Because so many things that bother a lot of people seem trivial to me. And the lesson of complementarity, the idea that you can put yourself in the other person's shoes, it's very, very helpful and kind of in dealing with the human comedy. And
yeah, that your truth may
people.
Be true and my truth is true and that can just be.
Yeah, and you know, and I can appreciate you for what you are, even if you're annoying. I can have the fun of trying to understand where you're coming from, and even if I don't approve of it. You know, having a wider view and an expanded mind. Mm-hmm. But then also another, you know, very important thing is that several hours a day I get to think about how beautiful the world is and how it might be made even more beautiful by enriching our understanding of it. So that's a very special gift, and I'm very grateful that I've society has paid me to do this, and I've been able to do it, and that I've had some talent and been able to do it in a successful way in some cases.
Yeah. I think that sense of fun and delight, you know, it's not an austere beauty. I mean, I know there's austere beauty in mathematics, but a lot of what you've been describing, it's passionate and whimsical. I think that's an...
Yes. People have different styles, but mine is that way. I'm a sunny kind of personality.
Yeah, and, but I don't think that's a way people think of a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, right? You know, it's...
Well, I know enough about Nobel Prize-winning physicists to know that they come in all shapes and sizes. And, you know, they don't have all that much in common, except not even intelligence. But all of them have in common that a certain kind of honesty and a certain kind of community, and they've all contributed in some significant way to human
and do you think they all
knowledge and culture and understanding.
Do you think they all have some sense of beauty as some kind of guiding principle, even if they wouldn't express it exactly the way you do?
Yeah. Some of them aren't really aware of it, but they do. Yeah, I think so. I think you have to, at some level, in some form, have the feeling for how things might be different and better in order to make a great discovery.
Mm.
I think you can be lucky, but even if you're lucky and stumble into something, you've got to realize that it's something and that you should pursue it. And that is usually driven by some feeling for beauty and that this thing is significant, that this thing fits into a larger picture. And, you know, making a discovery is not just stumbling into something. It's realizing that you've got it and bringing it to the world. And that requires a perception of its beauty.
I liked the dedication to your book, "To My Family and Friends, Beautiful Answers of the Second Kind." I'd love to know what that
Thank
means,
you.
And I'd love to know just, this is a huge question, but just how you'd begin talking about it. This really is the last question. You know, what you, not just what you know, what you continue to learn about through this entire life you live and what everything you think about what it means to be human.
Well, I try to keep expanding my sphere of knowledge and experience in very concrete ways. I mean, in writing this book and in some of my further adventures in recent months, I've developed an interest, for instance, in visual art that I didn't really have before.
Mm.
And it's come to mean a lot to me. Earlier, you know, when I was into early adulthood, I developed my knowledge of music and my experience of music much more deeply. I'm thinking about taking up juggling. There are lots of things that I'd love to do that I haven't done, and I look forward to doing them. It sounds trivial, but I think it's really important to keep expanding your experience, not only by thinking about new scientific theories, but in other ways. And I plan to keep doing that as long as I can.
And beautiful answers of the second kind.
And making new friends, yeah. And, making new friends is a very important activity to mm-hmm. me, too. And different kinds of friends. Most of my friends in the past have been colleagues at some level, plus mm-hmm. family. But now I'm meeting artists, I'm meeting musicians and some business people, and I'm expanding my circle, and it's a wonderful thing to be able to do that.
Mm. Yeah. Well, this has been
celebrities and personalities. it's marvelous to meet new people. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I just thoroughly enjoyed this, and your book is so beautiful. And
thank you.
And I really
thank you. It's meant a lot to me, and it came from the heart. Yeah.
Well, and I look forward to sharing it with other people, and I think people love to talk about these things, although they don't understand them. But I think what you're so articulate in actually creating entry points, right, where people don't have to understand special relativity to benefit from insights and discoveries.
Oh, I
of
agree.
Science,
I deeply
right?
agree with that.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, we don't insist that people take courses in art history before we admit them to art museums.
Right. Or that they have to understand music theory to love music. Right.
Right. Exactly.
But I think we are kind of collectively developing a vocabulary to speak about science in this way as part of culture and as part of the human inheritance.
Yes.
Right.
I think so. And I think mm-hmm. it's a wonderful thing.
And you're
thing.
Part of that.
And it's a very important thing because our modern life, technology, culture is based on science. But more than that, it's just a great opportunity to expand your mind. And we've learned so many beautiful, surprising things about the world. It's a pity not to experience them and enjoy them and learn about them.
Well, and it's so thrilling when you do. Just to understand a little bit is thrilling. So thank you for your work.
And well, thank you. I've enjoyed this thoroughly. And, good luck with it.
We'll let you know when we're putting it on the air. You'll be fully informed. And I look forward to continuing to read you and follow you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And feelings mutual.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.